Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley welcoming you to episode 51 of Criterion Reflections. Chin up, eyes forward, shoulders back, hands on hips, knees to the floor, erect posture, focused attention, undivided concentration. You are now ready to participate in The Ceremony, a 1971 film by Nagisa Oshima. I invite you to be present, listen, and consider the views, opinions, and earnest convictions that you are about to witness. We are here to discuss this pivotal film in Nagisa Oshima's prodigious output. I've got a few great guests. Very happy to welcome back Grant Douglas Bromley, Josh Hornbeck, and Trevor Barrett. Trevor will be joining us sort of as a add-on at the end of the podcast, so please listen all the way through. Appreciate your listening, your participation, and your faithful adherence to the rites of the ritual that we are about to experience. All right, let's get into the ceremony. Now that the introductions are out of the way, we are ready to launch into the event itself. So joining me for this first segment of the podcast, Grant Douglas Bromley. Grant, hello again and welcome back.
Howdy, it's a pleasure.
It's definitely great to get you back in on the Oshima journey here. You've been with us on a few of these conversations and super eager to hear your thoughts on what looks to be a pretty landmark film in Oshima's very illustrious catalog. But tell us a little bit of what you've been up to lately.
Just living the blissful post-grad school life. been watching a ton of silent films lately. Kind of doing a little project to get to 100 silent features seen, because I realized I've never seen a Charlie Chaplin movie. And so I'm gonna watch 100 silent films by other directors, since I've never seen one by Chaplin, and then my 101st will be a Charlie Chaplin movie.
Do you have a particular idea which one it'll be? I'm so fascinated to figure out what would you select.
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, it's kind of weird to think I went through 7 years of film school and not once did someone teach a Charlie Chaplin film, and
Times have changed. Let's just say that, because Charlie was Charlie was obligatory. That's not a bad one. Obviously, there's City Lights, there's Modern Times, there's The Gold Rush. You can go back into some of his early shorts there if you really want to kind of. But it seems like for 101, it should be one of the key features. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Well, if you're looking for recommendations, I'll put my
I'm at the right place. But yeah, I mean, beyond that, just writing a lot of essays and having a good time. So it's great to be back.
Yeah. Well, I always enjoy you. You have this kind of systematic kind of working through the catalog. I like how you track like the eighth film by, whatever director. But you've obviously got a pretty good comprehensive system going there. A nice approach. And I just really enjoy the work you're doing. So great to have you with us. Excellent.
Thank you.
And then guest number two for this part of the podcast is Josh Hornbeck, one of the regulars around here. Josh, how's it going?
It's great. It's good to be back. The last two times I've recorded with you, I've been in other cities. So this time I'm in Denver for another conference and recording from my hotel room. So it's always a pleasure to chat with you when I'm on the road.
Yeah, it seems like we sync with your travel schedule pretty nicely
there. That's right.
And I appreciate you, making some time for us. I guess we kind of keep you out of trouble in the after-hours conference party scene there.
So. Exactly.
All right. Well, we did a little bit of a preliminary conversation before we hit the record button. So, Josh, you're going to kind of give us a little capsule here. And, let's just say this is a challenging film. It's a... It's a very significant work in Oshima's career, a summation of sorts, and one that I hear you have a pretty good reaction to. So tell us, what are we in for when we step into the ceremony?
Yeah, so The Ceremony is a film about the Sakurada clan, a family that has a lot of wealth and influence and power within Japanese society. And we track the lives of four children, essentially, from just after World War II into the present day. And we see their relationship with their elders through a series of ceremonies, through weddings and funerals, as they gather. And we get to see the decline of this family over the course of these ceremonies, over the course of these weddings and funerals. And it's also really reads as Oshima's allegory for what was happening in Japan at the time, and the mess that the older generations left for the youth, and the challenges that are faced in trying to escape the cycles, to try to escape the ceremonies, the rituals of the past that keep them tethered into some really destructive cycles. It's a very theatrical film, and yet it's also, I feel like, one of Oshima's most expansive films at the same time. It's one that I've seen three times now. It was one of my early Oshima films, and I am completely captivated by it, and am excited to start digging into it.
Excellent. Okay, well, I guess I want to get over to Grant for a second, but let me just kind of react to what you said here. This is a film that I think, yeah, does have its strong adherence, people who really think this is peak Oshima, you know, and then there's others who might find this daunting, a bit of a struggle, a bit of a slog. He doesn't bring out the kind of razzle dazzle, you know, kind of Godardian stuff, at least as I see it. And so in that sense, it doesn't have some of that kind of kick-ass entertainment value, if you will, of Oshima the outlaw, the renegade, you know, grab you by the throat indie filmmaker. But he has some pretty deep themes going on here. And so yeah, I'm interested, maybe not to bias or skew your response, Grant, but tell us a little bit. I mean, where does this rank with you? I know you're a big Oshima fan.
Yeah, mean, I am. I'm a huge Oshima fan. I think he's one of the top five greatest filmmakers of all time. But, I shouldn't say but, but with this particular film, which I actually do enjoy quite a lot, this is my second time to see it. The first time I saw it while I was kind of chronologically making my way through Oshima's filmography. I still have, I think, only three films left that I haven't gotten to. But this particular film struck me, and even now it kind of does, as what would have been a perfect kind of end note to, you know, had he just stopped making films after this, it would have felt like just that perfect kind of swan song or, you know, something that everyone wishes a great director would have. But of course, he went on to make my favorite film of his, In the Realm of the Senses, two films later. So I'm thankful he didn't stop here. But yeah, I do find it very interesting as a post-war kind of family drama, a very strange family drama, lots of incest and other ideas that relate to some earlier Oshima films that you've discussed in previous podcasts. But then it also, I mean, it has plenty of stuff that's looking to In the Realm of the Senses as well. It finds a way of being totally him while just really dealing with the culture of contemporary Japan and this post-war kind of malaise.
Yeah, and I the narrative device of how this film is constructed is pretty interesting, because it is a film that's set in the present time. You know, Josh, you kind of, you know, kind of hinted at how it sort of moves from 1946 to, you know, then current day 1971. So we're talking about, you know, 25 years, 2.5 decades, a period of incredible tumult in Japanese society. And of course, as I've been working myself through the Criterion Collection chronologically, we've discussed, Japanese wartime films on the Eclipse Viewer with the Kinoshita set, or the first films of Kurosawa, the post-war reconstruction period with post-war Kurosawa and many others. I've done other individual podcasts on some of the Sun Tribe films. And of course, the Kurosawa classical period, Yojimbo, Sanjuro, High and Low, Redbeard, Ozu, of course, in all of that. This is very much a summation. And 1971 was a pretty pivotal year. I think that was the year of Yukio Mishima's kind of thwarted rebellion there, and his, mind-bending suicide and attempted coup and all of that. So this really is kind of the end of an era, and I think it is even kind of the end of an era in Oshima's filmmaking, because you're right, he did have several other films that he made afterwards, and they are kind of big, in some ways, glossy international productions. This feels like he's kind of wrapping up his very acerbic commentary on Japanese society. But as I was beginning to, before I meandered there a little bit, you've basically got a journey that starts at the beginning of this film as a man and a woman are on their way to answer an enigmatic telegram that they've received. That's Masuo and Ritsuko, who seem to be lovers, but also seem to be relatives. And there's a little bit of shadiness going on there. But they're going to see a man named Teramuchi. His telegram is, "Teramuchi is dead, signed Teramuchi," or something of that sort. Right. It's like, uh-oh, that seems a little disturbing, a little ominous, right? And so there is a linear trajectory here, as you see Masuo and Ritsuko kind of making their way first by train, then by ship, and then ultimately by boat to figure out where is Teramuchi and what's happened to him. And along the way, you see this kind of sequence of flashbacks starting in 1946 throughout the 1950s, and the events just kind of get more and more bizarre as the movie goes on. And so, it starts off as a kind of a post-war saga, a mother and son and others who are kind of brought back from Manchuria, where I don't know if they were like political prisoners or refugees, I'm a little bit lost on some of the details myself. How did they get to Manchuria, and how did they get back to Japan? Maybe we can start telling a little bit of the story there.
I think from my understanding, they were living in Manchuria as part of the Japanese Empire before the war started.
The occupation there, right?
Yeah, and then with the ending of World War II and the defeat of Japan, everyone was beginning to leave and be repatriated back to Japan. We learned that Masuo's father had come back to Japan years earlier, during the war, and had taken his own life. And the reason given for that was that he realized that the emperor was not divine, or that the emperor was renouncing his divinity, and he didn't want to live in a world where that had happened.
Yeah, he was all in on Japanese militarism and that expanding empire.
Yeah.
And with the death of that Japan, life was no longer worth living, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and so Masuo and his mother seem to have endured hardships at the hands of the Russians, the Koreans, and the Chinese, and eventually made their way back to Japan to live with Masuo's father's family.
And that's the grandfather, played by a very familiar face, Asai Kato. And kind of a grayed up hair treatment there, but a perfect casting. He is such a unique presence in so many of these great 60s era, early 70s Japanese films, and he has that great kind of sinister laugh. But he is the kind of the late era patriarch, you know. He's got an iron fist, and everybody is just definitely, you know, under the heel, to mix my metaphors there,
yeah,
of this very imperious man, in even to the extent of many tangled rumors, or beyond rumors, substantiations of incestuous relationships, sexual abuse. I've been kind of recounting my own journey of the recent, most recent episode we talked about was Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, another young man brought up in very morally compromised situation. And yeah, but he's coming from the kind of bottom rung of society. Here we've got that same kind of moral rot happening kind of at the upper echelons of power and privilege here. And how many people are made to suffer because the grandfather is just so unyielding in his greed and selfishness and his insistence that the family bloodline be kept pure. So there is this very twisted family drama, but as you have both said, there's a commentary on the larger Japanese society that's going on as well.
Yeah, definitely. And just to kind of continue on that, it's interesting that Kei Sato, the grandfather, how he kind of runs this old Japanese kind of order, cult of sorts, that they can't get out of the past, the shadow of old Japan. And the grandfather, you know, assigns Masuo to live two lives, one for the brother who died in Manchuria before they were repatriated, and then one, of course, for himself. But he's living in the shadow of his own dead father, and then, of course, defeated nation. And this defeated nation is just kind of embodied by this cult-like family that now he's being moved back into, in the same way that his family is repatriated back into Japan. So there's an interesting parallel there. And then and then the incest kind of comes in, and it all kind of comes together.
Yeah, you know, the settings, the kind of architecture and the structure of these ceremonies, you very rarely see people just hanging out. You know, everybody's kneeling on their mats in a very formal, rigid posture, impeccable arrangements. The interiors are always dark with very dramatic, sometimes it seems like, you know, single spotlight, you know, lighting. There's these, you know, kind of braziers, these open flames that are just, you know, burning at different points. That's like, man, isn't there like a fire hazard here? Or what? I hope they have some good ventilation or something. But it's a very eerie atmosphere. And especially you think about the post-war period, you think about the Ozu films, or even some of Kurosawa's, you know, domestic dramas, and you see a very different slice of life in Japan. I would say this is probably a very stylized portrait, but there's a method to Oshima's, well, I wouldn't even say madness here. I mean, there is madness, there is insanity, but it's very rigidly controlled and with a purpose.
Yeah. And you get the sense that through this family drama and through these rituals that are depicted on screen, that Oshima's offering up not only a commentary of Japanese society, but of Japanese film. He's doing his take, you know, on the Ozu dramas. He has been quoted many times as saying that he has a distaste for all Japanese cinema, including his own. And, you know, so he seems to be really interested in exploring. There's a grotesquerie to the film. It's almost a horror film without ghosts and monsters, which, you know, he goes on to make Empire of Passion, which is an actual ghost story. And you get the sense that this family is haunted by the legacy of this grandfather who is still alive, but he's an eerie, almost demonic presence in their lives.
Yeah, when he laughs, he is like one of those specters that just kind of lurks in the shadows and comes popping out when you're least prepared and most ready to be terrified, you know? I think that's a great analogy of just how unsettling, the grandfather in particular is, but you see the kind of ripple effects of Setsuko and Ritsuko, the mother and daughter, who are also, they're kind of demonic women, you know, in their own way. Though Masuo finds himself allured and what he considers to be in love with Ritsuko in particular. That's the woman that he kind of starts off the movie with. But he's got his moments with Setsuko as well. And it's just, And as I'm thinking about this, especially for any listeners who haven't maybe quite buckled down to watch this yet, we want to kind of get this portion of the episode, you know, maybe as a little bit of a prep so that you know what you're getting into. So I don't always advocate for taking notes, but if you really want to make this a one-shot watch to really get it, you might want to have your finger on the pause button to try to scope things out or actually do a little bit of reading ahead of time, because there is some great literature on this film and this period of Oshima's work as well.
Yeah, and I'll say that for me, when I first saw it, I was intrigued by it, but I didn't find it as immediately accessible as things like Death by Hanging or some of the films that are in the Oshima Eclipse set. Mm-hmm. But as I rewatched it just before Filmstruck expired, I wanted to get one last watch in before we recorded this episode, because we weren't sure at that point whether it would be back or not. That second viewing blew me away. It immediately captivated me in a way that I didn't expect it to. And watching it today for a third time, I continue to be in awe of how Oshima structures this film, of what he's doing with the scene compositions, as you were saying, David, the lighting contrasts, the very theatrical staging and blocking, and the use of lighting is so striking, and the music especially is really, really such a powerful part in creating that sense of dread that infuses the entire film.
Absolutely. Well, and every time the bass hits in Toru Takemitsu's score, I'm just like, it gives you goosebumps.
Yeah.
And I mean, some of the timing of the bass note from it almost sounds like a standing bass, being struck, you know, whether it's the grandfather's hand going on the leg of Aunt Setsuko, or and even just the first time you hear it in the opening credits of the film, which are quite lengthy, giving us the 10-year anniversary of the Art Theater Guild and all that, which is another kind of end of an era, or, you know, maybe not end of an era, but an important milestone in Japanese film. And, you know, these are the films that are produced by the Art Theater Guild are, I think, some of the greatest. And this film is working with so many ideas that you see in, like, Shohei Imamura films, like Profound Desire of the Gods, and of course, just Oshima's own work. But I don't know, you're right, it's a spooky film, and then throw in that Kai Sato is a young man as a grandfather, almost like Orson Welles playing old in Citizen Kane, and this movie has some Citizen Kane kind of vibes with the getting rid of a particular item from childhood and fire, and and other kinds of elements, just the use of flashback and snow at the beginning, all kinds of stuff. I don't know. It's an eerie film to see this haunting, demonic presence of Kai Sato and this freaky bass notes, and I don't know. It's wonderful, but it's very challenging.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to yield up its secrets easily. How much do you think a basic knowledge of Japanese history is you know, necessary. I mean, maybe we can, you know, do a little bit of recap along that line, because again, I don't have post-war Japanese history down to a science where I can say, well, 1952, this was the big thing, and 56, there's where it was at. But you know, to those 2 years are specifically cited, and I think 52 might have been, if not the very end, but pretty close to the end of the American occupation. And I think in 56 is when sort of the post-war reconstruction sort of was coming to a conclusion. And then the, you know, I mentioned the Sun Tribe films and kind of the new youth that were coming up, the first truly post-war generation of Japanese kids who really didn't have a lot of, you know, formative experiences in the war years. And now they were ready to take daddy's, you know, prosperity and run off and have some fun with it, and didn't harbor any ill will towards America. In fact, found the West fascinating. And so you've got these, you know, these kind of milestones of Japanese history, recent history kind of unfolding. And that's when some of these ceremonies take place. I don't know, how much did just kind of that progression of the Japanese economy, the reconstruction of society, and this new way of being Japan, I think that does seem to be a lot of the background context of what Oshima is getting at here. And I think he has some problems. You know, he clearly does. You know, if you read his writings, which are voluminous, he was not a man just content to let history take its course. He had some ideas, he had some leanings in some different ways, and he did not see some of his philosophies being put into practice. He had a pretty robust critique. I don't know, either you guys want to pick up on that whole idea of just kind of, you know, the course of Japanese culture and Oshima's response to it?
Yeah, you know, I, in some of my reading today about the film and some different people's takes on it, something that was mentioned was that the dates of each of the ceremonies that we get are really important dates in what was going on in Japanese history. And just reading that made me eager to dig in more, and I haven't had the chance yet. But I know that before a fourth viewing of this, that'll be something I'll really want to explore, because I think that it will help us understand even to greater depths what's going on. Because I think there's so much symbolism in all of these elements. And I do think that Oshima's own leftist tendencies are here, but he's also such an idiosyncratic political filmmaker that he has harsh words for both the left and the right within Japanese society, and seems to be really angry at the isolation and the sense that Japanese culture is becoming incestuous itself. That seems to be a major part of what's going on here. This family is isolated, and as we've said, there's a lot of incest within this family, and that seems to be the thrust of what he's exploring and critiquing here as well. We get this idea, the baseball that keeps recurring, the motif of this Western game is such a moment of hope for Masuo. It's what he thinks is going to save him. It's going to pull him out. He rejects it at times and comes back to it and continues to come back to it. And it makes me think that Oshima is saying that the only way for us to move forward is in community, in exchange of cultural ideas with others. We can't become this hermetically sealed, this pure and unblemished Japan.
Well, definitely, and I, you know, this might be reading into it too much, but I mean, you think about the isolation that Japan had in the 1800s before Commodore Perry, I think it was, kind of opened up Japan to the West. And then, of course, you know, spoilers, at the end of the film, they're on a boat and they're getting to their destination by sea. And there's something special about that. And then, of course, you know, baseball. I like that baseball could be kind of the thesis of this movie, American pastime. And
but one that the Japanese society had really embraced. I mean, I true, think, yeah. You know, with a lot of us focusing on Japanese film, you think, oh, 1952, wasn't that like Seven Samurai? And 56, wasn't that, you know, you start kind of ticking off the developments in Japanese film. But there were a lot of other things going on. And baseball was becoming a huge you know, business, a crowd-pleasing attraction. And for a young man like Masuo, who, you know, he's you know, probably dealing with his own, you know, childhood traumas and stuff, but baseball represents an outlet where you can put your, you know, physical energy, and there's an athleticism about it, but there's also a strategy and a skill. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be a, you know, a big beefy, you know, football player or sumo wrestler. You know, if a person of average stature can become very skilled at that. And there's also the kind of the recollection of pleasant childhood memories, which plays a pretty big role in his love-hate relationship with the game. You know, there's a part of him that wants to just stamp it out. His mother died while he was out of town playing baseball on a team, and so he misses his chance to have that last moment of, whether that's just of companionship or reconciliation, but he did not have a chance to say his goodbyes to his mother, so that there's kind of a haunting that comes from that. But then there's those happier times of childhood innocence. You know, you kind of alluded to the Citizen Kane angle. I like that connection. Those, you know, simpler times and those, you know, hearkening back memories to when life's pressures were, you know, just a whisper of what they are now. Yeah. Yeah, and that's a very interesting idea, because you're right. This is a non-Japanese element that plays a very significant role in the drama of the film, and yet with the utter defeat of Japan in the post-war period, you also get the sense that Oshima and a lot of his other kind of student radical activists recognize this is a chance to really, you know, scrub the decks and start fresh and rebuild society according to ideals, a model that unfortunately the forces of commerce and tradition you know, kind of thwarted that opportunity, and they, you know, kind of was a hybrid of old style traditionalism with, you know, Western hypercapitalism, and Oshima just really wasn't content with that outcome.
Yeah. There's something too, if we get into a little bit of the meat, there's that sequence a little more than halfway through where Masuo gets married, and it's probably the most uncomfortable and humiliating wedding sequence I've seen in any film.
It's absolutely incredible. That is definitely the payoff, especially if you've been kind of grinding away to sort of keep track of who's who and how these characters all connect with each other. Even if you don't, if you're a little befuddled by all of that, the wedding is incredible.
Yeah. And so Masuo is supposed to be married off to the daughter of a wealthy family. And just before the wedding, someone comes to Masuo and his family and says that the bride has developed appendicitis and has to go in for an emergency operation. And instead of postponing the wedding, Masuo's grandfather decides to go forward with the wedding because there are people who are there to
distinguished visitors.
Yes. Yeah. And so Masuo has to go through this empty ritual without a bride by his side. And we see this really, again, there's a ghostly sense about it, that there's this invisible person there. And the thing that struck me the most this time through was the person at the head table next to Masuo is talking about the bride and describing all of her characteristics and says she is a pure, unblemished, true Japanese woman.
Who doesn't actually exist.
Exactly, right. Exactly. And so, again, that's got me thinking so much about the insular nature that this family seems to be really advocating, this idea that we can remain pure and 100% Japanese and we can remain isolated and cut off. And yet there's no one there to represent that. And there's just something about that I find so fascinating and so eager to continue to explore.
Go ahead, Grant. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say it's amazing too to look at how those scenes are filmed. Many of them in the big banquet kind of area where they cut the cake, or well, I say they, where he on his own cuts the cake. So much of it is filmed in wide shots, long shots, where we see all the distinguished guests and family. And everything's kind of shown from a distance. So we get this sense of this is the community. These are the people who are, you know, homogenous. They're, you know, the incest that's taking place. And even the self-love. There's no one else there. It's just him and him alone.
Yeah.
But he's surrounded by all these people who are with the same mentality. And they all kind of watch as if it's kind of normal. And yeah. The camera tracks along as he walks the hand of his imaginary bride, and which is kind of Godardian, the tracking movements. Yeah. But it's really awkward. I used to be a wedding videographer, and I wish I could have filmed this wedding.
Awesome. Well, it's kind of an Emperor's New Clothes moment, because there's not a single person in the entire crowd who's willing to call it out and say,
yeah.
Except for what Tadashi, he's the younger, he's the younger brother. He's kind of the kid tag along of this little quartet, and he's the one who pulls out his manifesto for a new Japan and wants to blow the lid off of this farce. And of course, the minute he pipes up, this swarm of security guys just come. I mean, it's crazy. Like, they were all just in the starting blocks, ready to go. The minute one person steps out of line, they haul him off, and that in itself is a pretty incredible moment, because dissent will not be tolerated here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the occasion of the wedding itself, this couple is actually a very much a sideshow. This is a demonstration of power and tradition, and everybody's going to eat their meal and maintain their dignified silence while this absurdity unfolds at the bridal table. At the wedding party, that doesn't matter. You know, both of those chairs could have been empty, but the ritual would continue, you know? And then, of course, let's talk about Masuo as kind of his old, the switcheroo, his revenge, if you will, once they get back to the groom's chamber and it's time to consummate the marriage. Who wants to kind of give us a little walkthrough of that memorable moment?
There's that whole thing of anime pillows.
And, okay, yeah.
You know, and I felt that this kind of felt like a precursor to the anime pillow. He continues kind of acting out the wedding tradition, as it were. He's going to consummate his relationship.
Yes.
In drunk, out of his mind, and then the grandfather enters, and well, he becomes subject of the incest as well, and it's wild, lots of laughter and cackling, and a lot of people also looking on in shock, and then of course the grandfather responding to being dragged to the ground by his grandson of sorts.
Well, basically getting humped.
Exactly. I'm trying to keep it G for the kids, but yeah.
Well, and in the midst of this too, we also have Tadashi's wake, which is part of this bridal, the bridegroom chamber.
Yeah, supposedly he got thrown out in the street and got run over, but it's very questionable, very shaky, shady, whatever actually happened to him. But he's dead now.
And so they're
sobbing and reading the tracks of his manifesto. It's an incredible kind of combination of things with this post-wedding and now this funeral of sorts, this wake.
Yeah, and I think we start to see in this sequence the grandfather slowly losing his power for the first time in the film. We have heard through anecdotes that the grandfather has forced himself on many of the women in this family. And at this point, we have Masuo forcing himself on the grandfather. And there's this really interesting reversal in dynamic that's happening.
Yeah, right. It is. It's a retaliation. It's not an especially effective one. It doesn't really end grandfather's reign, but it certainly signals that, you know, this gross offense, this egregious abuse of power and privilege is nearing the end of its era. And yeah, and that is kind of where Oshima is taking us here. As we see, you know, even within the dynamics of the, you know, the three surviving children after Tadashi is dead, you've got Teramuchi, you've got Ritsuko, and you've got Masuo, and how are all these tensions going to be resolved? Maybe we can leave that part a little bit, you know, in spoiler-free territory there. But I think the film does come to a very powerful resolution as these, you know, somewhat opaque threads become a little bit more clear. This is definitely not a too late at night. You know, hopefully you've not had too many, mellowing out beverages, because this is one where you're going to have to stay a little bit sharp to kind of reach the destination that Oshima is escorting us toward.
Yeah. And I'll say that, you know, it's only in the third time that I'm starting to get the vast cast of characters starting to get them straight and starting to understand. Right,
you've also got the communist uncle, and there's a couple other kind of older male figures who, you know, they're side players, but they have some interesting, parts to play, and they shed lights on other sort of competing ideologies within the Japanese milieu of those post-war years.
Yeah. And I will say that final scene on the beach is among the most affecting and haunting that I've seen in all of Oshima. I find it to be absolutely riveting. And then we cut to black for a good chunk of time before we get the final end credit. And it just is... The techniques that he is using to cause us to reflect and to cause us to think about what's happening and the legacy of the Japanese elders, I think are just really, really fascinating.
Yeah, I think that last sequence kind of reminded me of Boy, which I think is probably Oshima's warmest film. At least that's one that registers with me as the most kind of humane and compassionate. Maybe it's because it's about a very troubled family, and in particular the child who's kind of at the heart of it all. And so you see, you know, Oshima kind of letting some of his, metallic edge, soften a little bit. And I think you get some of that same dynamic here. Grant, what are some of your thoughts as we kind of wrap things up, or, you know, this segment of the discussion anyways?
For me, one of the things that I was really drawn to about this film, the first time and the second time, as I am with many Oshima films, is just the camera direction. That's something that, I don't know. And with this film, so much of it, as I've kind of mentioned with the wedding, it's distant. And that kind of goes to what Josh was saying about you need a few viewings to kind of catch up with who is everybody, because so much of the film is keeping us kind of away from them. And, you know, when there is a close up, it's meaningful. And like, for example, when Masuo runs in to the see the casket of his mother. He's wearing his baseball uniform. He just starts sobbing. But then the camera cuts back, revealing everyone just on their knees, you know, like it's just another meeting of the clan. And and the camera just stays back there. It lingers with the casket in the background. And we don't go in for close-ups as the family members talk. And, I mean, you almost have to, you know, for me, not speaking Japanese, I have to look away from the subtitles to figure out, okay, wait, who's actually speaking right now?
Yeah.
I've got to see where the lips are moving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which is amazing to me, the confidence in his compositions. And, of course, it all pays off with the lighting and everything else that we've kind of mentioned. But I think that those are really, really strong in this film. And then throw in the incredible music, throw in the themes that are at play. And, I mean, that's where it just begins to feel like a final kind of note, an end to an era. And, you know, there's some real maturity in this film. You know, this isn't Pleasures of the Flesh, you know, or a film like that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He's really playing at his most serious.
Yeah, right.
Some of that youthful bravura is subsided. He and I think that those are great observations. You know, compared to like The Man Who Left His Will on Film, or even you know the even kind of wilder, more anarchic Diary of a Shinjuku Thief, which were kind of his preceding films, very experimental, very much shooting from the hip. Especially Shinjuku Thief, where he's just cobbling all kinds of footage together, you know, live student riots, and, you know, there's black and white, there's color. It's just kind of this, you know, mind-bending trip of a film. Here he's showing the fruits of all of his discipline, his studied approach to cinema, his you know, didactic political philosophies here. You know, there is an archness, and I, you know, there are a few reviews out there that kind of put this one towards the lower tier, maybe because some of those elements that you kind of enjoy or even think about, you know, Oshima's Outlaw 60s, as the Eclipse series is set, is titled. he's not really that guy here in this film. He's saying, okay, I'm going to sit down and talk to you about some stuff I've been thinking about for a while. And he's going to do it with that real steady, measured hand that says, you know, I got the chops. I can make me a serious movie. And it is. It's aesthetically very pleasing, but you're right. While you're tracking with the plots and the characters, you may be focused more on those white letters at the bottom of the screen. So,
well, just to connect it real quick to the Eclipse set, I mean, this film, and I think this particular film from the Eclipse set, Sing a Song of Sex, or A Treatise on Japanese Body Songs, it's a very mature film too, I think. But with this particular film, The Ceremony, he takes some of the ideas from A Treatise on Japanese Body Songs and elevates them, brings them to totally new heights at the wedding of one of the other family members.
Yeah, that musical sequence where everybody gets their song. It's kind of like a Japanese freestyle rap, like, you know,
right,
here comes
exactly
this guy, here goes that guy, and even the women get into it. That's another really remarkable sequence, again, very worthy of just checking that out even in isolation, just to kind of watch the characterizations and how they come to the forefront as each person sort of sings their characteristic tune.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems that this really is pointing the way forward for where he'll go, and that this really feels in some ways like not only a capstone on his 60s work, but a launch pad for where he's about to go.
So, so what is next? I mean, I know in the realm of the senses, what, 75? So that would Six. Think that there's something between this one and that one.
Yeah.
What's
Dear Summer Sister.
Okay.
I would say Next to Boy is his most friendly movie.
Okay.
But it's also is maybe next to Sing a Song of Sex and Double Suicide, it's maybe his most anti-Korean film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's a big kind of xenophobic kind of screed of sorts.
But does he have that streak in him? I thought he was more sympathetic toward the Korean cause. Or...
Well, I guess I mean his characters.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And,
yeah, okay.
Yeah. And because, you know, so many of his characters are opposed to others just because they are embodying the types that we see in Japanese mm-hmm. culture at this
okay,
time.
Okay, so he's
it seems.
Portraying the racism yeah. and the xenophobia. Okay, excellent.
Right, and yeah. it's an interesting film, but I don't think it's a very good film. I wish it was easier to see.
It's not in the Criterion Channel yeah. queue at this time. No, I don't think it's yeah. ever been part of their lineup going back to Hulu Plus or Filmstruck, where The Ceremony's been part of the Criterion Rights group for yeah. quite a while, yeah.
Yeah, but with just looking forward in the realm of the senses, of course, which is referenced in the Japanese body song sequence in The Ceremony.
Yes, yes.
It was Sade Abe getting a shout-out as he acts out, as one of the guys acts out getting his genitals cut off.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, yeah, I picked up on it. I didn't know that was the specific historic reference.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, I still have to get my way to Realm of the Senses there, so.
Oh.
But, yeah, not that you've spoiled it for me or anything like that. All right. Well, okay, final comments, guys. We probably should wrap this up. Give me and Trevor something to pick apart here. But yeah. Been fun to a fun conversation. Any last bits that you want to bring to the forefront before we wrap it up?
I'll just say that this is continuing to grow on me. I think Boy is another one that I need to revisit. I loved it when I first saw it, but this one right now is really standing out to me as one of my favorites among his entire catalog.
Yeah, do you think it would merit a standalone release?
I would hope so, but I think it's so obscure in yeah. many ways that I don't think it will. I think it might be part of a box set at some point. I think that's the only way I can see it getting a release.
The stream is pretty good quality. Yeah, go ahead, Grant.
Yeah.
No, I agree. The stream looks fantastic. And I hope that I'm praying for this box set, you know?
Yeah.
I want, you know, to be able to own Diary of a Shinjuku Thief and The Man Who Left His Will on Film and The Ceremony. I want to own these films and just be able to watch them all the time.
You know,
I know Criterion Channel will be with us for a long time, but I want to have that on my shelf.
Yeah, I agree.
With supplements and the works there, yeah.
Oh, please, yes.
All right, guys. Well, on that very wishful, hopeful, optimistic note, let's leave it there. Grant and Josh, thanks again, guys. Been good having you on, and we'll get you back on here real soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, yeah.
Okay, and so to wrap up this little ceremony that we've been indulging in here, I've got Trevor Barrett. Trevor, welcome back. Nice to talk to you again.
You too, David. Thanks for having me on at this late hour of the podcast.
Well, you know, we've covered a lot of the material. I suppose I've already spoken most of my main points. There may be a few things that'll come up and you know, really one of the main reasons I wanted to get you in on this episode is just because you and I have been on this Oshima journey together, you know, going back to our days in the Eclipse mm-hmm. Viewer and the Outlaw 60s set. And I think we've talked about, you know, some other Oshima films, certainly on this podcast. And, you know, just he's just been kind of part of the conversation. And I would say, you know, this registers as a significant entry into the Oshima oeuvre, and I just kind of wanted to hear what your thoughts were. I know you've had a chance to listen to me and Grant and Josh kind of hash out a few notions here, but what say ye, my friend?
Well, yeah, I did. I had a good opportunity to listen to what you three had to say about the film, and it was a really good conversation, by the way. As someone coming in, it's kind of a unique situation to be able to listen to the podcast and then join it. And yeah, and so yeah. It was really fun to listen to because I had rewatched the film again before listening to what you guys had to say. And I did take notes, David, just like you recommend in your episode. I completely recommend
that
to
people. For this one, yes. I think it makes sense. Yeah. And had you seen it before?
I watched it on Filmstruck before Filmstruck expired at the end of last year. And then rewatched it this past weekend on the Criterion channel. So yeah, I had seen it before. And the first time I watched it, I really liked it. But it was with the second viewing and with some, you know, reading going into it, where it really kind of came alive for me. A lot of the things that Oshima is exploring that really just sailed past my head the time before. I mean, the time before, it was a lot of gut reactions, and is this tone working for me? Do I like the characters? Is that weird enough? Yes, definitely weird enough at times. And in general, you know, that kind of just a more emotional response, where the second viewing, where I kind of had the map in front of me from the first viewing, I knew where we started, I knew who the characters were, which took me a while the first time through. You know, it really just kind of came together in all of its disturbing and at times really lovely exploration of, you know, what I would like to say he could have just as easily called Children of Regret. It's a line from the film where they're kind of talking about the Japanese government's regret following World War II and that they were all children of that regret. And I just thought, oh, that would have made a really good title of the film as well, because you've got these youngsters who just don't seem to have a place in the world. Their relationships are torn apart and confusing, and not just for the viewers but for themselves. And they're, you know, the old world is gone. It's still represented. It still has its very tangible presence in Grandpa, but it's really sterile now. I mean, everyone's dying. It's come down to the last few heirs, and they're expected to carry it on. But, you know, there's a lot of incest and insularity. It isn't going to survive. We know that. And, you know, it's just kind of, this is where these children are finding themselves as they grow up. And I really love how at the beginning, you know, one of the main characters we come to know may or may not have just committed suicide when the film begins. And it's the journey of the other two to go back and see if what they think may have happened actually happened. And
just like Masuo's father, we kind of, you know, revealed in the previous segment, yeah, he did kill himself. He sort of saw the trajectory that this fading empire was on. So he said, let's just get it over with now.
Yeah.
And the rest of the family is kind of living it out in slow motion. You know, the other, you talk about the Children of Regret, kind of a nice juxtaposition with the fairly early Kurosawa film, No Regrets for Our Youth. This is kind of Oshima's, you know, Kurosawa, especially at that stage in his career, was a kind of the resolute optimist, you know, just making the best of a bad situation. And Oshima's kind of, 25 years later, sending the rebuttal. No, it really was pretty bad, and it still is, and it's getting worse, you know.
This was really interesting to watch in the context of those post-war, or, you know, even during the war films that we covered in the Eclipse Viewer, because you've got that hindsight. It, you know, some of the things are familiar. There are the Americans who, you know, all we can get are the scraps that they're feeding their pigs. And, you know, remembering them from some of those other films in the Eclipse Viewer, the occupying power and how the people are dealing with it. Well, in this particular film, there really is a bleak look at that post-war society and what pre-war society had to offer. It's not, I don't think that Oshima is saying if we could only go back to the way things were. I think he's saying that was bad. And this is bad, and things just aren't working out very well.
Yeah, and there was that opportunity to try to make things better. I think that's, you know, that is the appeal and the promise of revolution. After we survive all the misery, if we're fortunate enough to do so, we can remake our order. We can chart a new course. And as I've already kind of commented, this kind of marked the resignation that, yeah, that experiment really wasn't going to pay dividends, that Japan had kind of chosen a different way. And so, you know, you kind of get the sense that this family saga is kind of a dead end. You know, Ritsuko is certainly not looking to, you know, move into a new future. Masuo, in the final image of the film, he's kind of caught in a reminiscence of his past, and that's really the end of it.
Well, the whole film is his regret in a way, and his stunted growth. I mean, every relationship he's ever been in, his dreams of being a baseball player, those are all over when the film begins, and it's his reflection on all of that, and it doesn't come to any kind of new horizon at the end of the film.
No. There's you know, pretty much the script that's been written for them is to, you know, reenact these various ceremonies, you know, weddings and funerals, and even baseball itself is a form of ceremony. It's certainly got its rituals, you know, from the, you know, the stretch and the toss of the pitch and the little things that the batter does at the plate and the, you know, the whole pageantry of the game itself. Just very interesting. One of the things that Gashiki is the Japanese title. And I read one of the reviews said, actually, this probably should have been translated as ceremonies, you know, the plural, because that's really what the film is.
I wondered about a sequence
of that.
In fact, one of my questions when I finished it was, well, which one of those was the ceremony? And I wondered, I was probably going too deep and thinking maybe the whole, like, life, you know?
It's all one big ritual.
Good to know it wasn't quite that overt and deep. I guess just one thing that I did want to touch on were some of my concerns going into the film. In case there are listeners who haven't watched the film yet, they might be turned off at the beginning, because I kind of was. You know, it's hard, I think, to get into an Oshima film. He doesn't open the door for you. You just kind of have to go in and make your way around the room and figure these things out. And it's also...
And he's kind of indifferent as to whether or not you want to get on board, almost.
Yeah,
it's like,
he's
certainly... if you want to take this journey with me, here you go. You'll have to kind of find your way, but I'm not going to make it easy.
I was glad that he didn't, and I noticed you mentioned these kind of the Godardian tricks and things like that. I was glad that it wasn't that kind of stuff. It was just a lot of ellipsis and things that you don't really know who these characters are, who they're talking about, what their relationship is, but it wasn't the... And all of a sudden, they're somewhere else and upside down and backwards. And, you know, it wasn't quite that tricksy, I guess. But it is bleak. And it's hard at first to know if Masuo is going to be a sad sack with his really drawl, heavy voiceover narration, which is a thing of the film I did not like, actually. Or if he's going to be able to pull off something genuinely poignant as the film goes on. And I did find it ultimately genuinely poignant, very interesting, very disturbing. You know, this is not a film to watch. If you haven't watched any Oshima before, you know, he's not afraid to go places that most others, even, you know, even provocateurs, sometimes just don't go, because, you know, he's okay doing that. And he does have a deeper message with it, but it can be very provocative. But yeah, when it started the first time, I was a little bit wary, just kind of thinking, oh, how oblique is he going to be? How tough is this going to be to figure it out? And I think he does pull it off very nicely. And that opening segment with the youth was just my favorite part of the film. When Masuo comes back to Japan, I thought the camera work was lovely and luscious and kind of introduces, I think, Oshima's next phase of his career, some of the more lyrical camera work and more luscious scenery. That opening segment with them as youth out playing and kind of getting to know each other as youth, and you know, the ghostliness almost of those scenes where he'd kind of pan the camera around and all of a sudden the other youth would be there. you know, that kind of reminded me of what Oshima is about to do. more than what he has done in the past. And then when you get into all the ceremonial stuff, it started to remind me a little bit more of some of the films in the Outlaw 60s set. Again, not quite as overtly bombastic and crazy, but, you know, a little bit more theatrical and in those ways, and much more political. I really loved that first opening scene, though, and that kind of pulled me in and helped me get through it. Because, I don't know, I guess sometimes when Oshima's films start, I kind of have to sit there and wonder, okay, is this the undergraduate's deep, you know, philosophical play, you know, that's going to be put on at the theater tonight? Or is this someone who's got it all put together and who, in this kind of dramatic, you know, heavy stuff, going to help me feel something beyond just the overt metaphors and allegories, because it's a very allegorical film. It could really fall apart pretty easily, but I think he pulls it off.
I would agree. I think there's definitely substance here. You know, the flash is definitely a little bit more subdued, and this does feel, you know, as again I've already said, this is kind of a summation of a lot of the themes that he's already explored and kind of bringing him to a new peak. You know, as I'm thinking here, you know, you and I talked about the Diary of a Shinjuku Thief in the very first episode of this podcast, and I think we gave it about, what, 20 minutes?
And I still don't know what that movie is about.
Yeah, and but then we talked about Boy, which I think we both really liked quite a bit and were pretty impressed by. Obviously, this veers more towards that. You know, substantial, grounded vein of Oshima's work.
Put together. Even when he's doing something like Death by Hanging, which is darkly funny, it's put together and works. You know, and then he's got the other ones like Diary of a Shinjuku Thief, which just, I honestly, maybe I'm missing stuff, but it just doesn't work for me.
It's very much kind of a late 60s pastiche of just all these different things. I think even at the time of our podcast, I kind of likened it almost to like a video blog of just kind of like, here's what I've been up to lately. Let's cobble it together and make an art film out of it. And I'm glad he didn't go too far down that rabbit hole, I guess, as a one-off oddball experiment. Then, hey, it's what it is. The Man Who Left His Well in Film. I don't think you were on that episode.
No,
that
I was. What, I think yeah. something. I was planning on it, and something pulled me off. I don't remember what, but yeah, I wasn't on that one.
Had you had a chance to see that one?
Yeah, I did. I watched it for the episode.
Okay, and it just didn't. Yeah, it didn't get into the final conversation there. But
yeah.
I mean, where would you put this? I mean, we don't have to get heavy into a ranking, and maybe I haven't really given you time to prepare that, but do you have like a middle, upper, lower tier Oshima? Where would you put this?
I'd probably put this in the middle tier, toward the upper end. I think he's done better things before it, and I think he'll do better things after it. I actually really see this as a transitionary film in many ways, where it highlights a lot of the things that I liked about his early work and, again, introduces some of the things I like about his later work and sits very nicely there in the middle. I wouldn't put it up there with some of the ones that we talked about in the podcast or in the Eclipse Viewer. I wouldn't put it up there with Death by Hanging or the others that are on Criterion's mainline release, Empire of the Senses, or no...
Empire of Passion.
Empire of Passion, Realm of the Senses. Those are just kind of in a different league, but this is a very good film. I don't know. What about you? I don't...
We talked a little bit about, you know, would this ever see disc publication, and I think it deserves it, but I think it would be better served as kind of part of a box. And I think...
I had the same thought, by the way.
I think it's very deeply grounded in... Japanese society and family traditions and really is maybe even more than some of these other films, a relic of its time, that would really require the broader audience to have to work a little bit to get into this film. So yeah. This is one you sort of want to have to be on board with it. You know, maybe you've already been intrigued and enchanted by Oshima, and you're determined to kind of work through the obstacles and get to where he's taken you.
Yeah, not a good blind buy in the July sale. You know, take right, it home right. And pop it in the player. I don't think it would work that way, but it certainly works mm-hmm. as part of an exploration of his work.
Yeah, of a serious artist with plenty to say, a mastery of a whole range of techniques and cinematic styles, and you know, in that sense, very worthy, even close to being essential. I think yeah, you could probably skip over Shinjuku Thief. You might even be able to, you know, breeze past some of the stuff in the Eclipse set. I think of was it Pleasures of the Flesh? I mean, they're all pretty cool movies in their own way, but I think The Ceremony probably ranks to me a little bit meatier than some of the films mm-hmm. in that set. And yet, you know, they're of a piece. And so one of the things I love about the Eclipse series is how they kind of group films together and create that synergy that makes the whole thing even a little bit greater than the films as individual yeah. works. So yeah, so yeah, I definitely welcome an Oshima part two or even part three. Our friend Daisuke Beppu put some pretty positive comments about The Ceremony. He ranks it up amongst one of his favorite Oshima films, so I want to give him a little shout out for some of the, you know, contributions he gave me in terms of my own preparation for this, and I hope he's listening in and enjoying the conversation here. And I look forward to any comments he and other listeners may have as you give us your own reaction to The Ceremony. So any final comments while we wrap this up, Trevor?
No. Again, thanks for making time for me. After I listened to the episode, I kind of thought, man, I'd really love to talk with David about the film, but I don't want to waste his time. You know, I feel like it was still a fun, good little cap.
I appreciate having you along the way, and hopefully when we get to the realm of the senses, you'll be right there alongside me to kind of keep the conversation humming along. It's a ways off. It's a 1975 film, so we got a few seasons to go before we're back into Oshima's world, but we'll certainly be
quite the world
living in our we'll be living in our memories and imagination. Before I let you go, what have you been up to with the Mooks and the Gripes and just life in general?
Ooh, boy, I love spring. It starts to feel like I'm waking up again, and so it has been a lot of opportunities to read and maybe dig into the Criterion Channel just a little bit more, but it's been a little bit quiet. I've been focusing on shorter things, some of the shorts on the Criterion Channel, some short stories mm-hmm. and such.
Anything that's particularly jumped out at you that say, hey, I want to plug this and recommend it to the listeners?
Not yet. As far as the Criterion Channel, I've only just mm-hmm. started that like about a week ago. But as far as short stories, you know, that I've probably been spending even more time with them. You know, my two favorites, Alice Munro and William Trevor. I never stop reading them. I've been reading them a story a week for quite a while. And David.
And they have a large enough body of work to sustain that sort of episodic you know, approach. Or do you reread?
I haven't done too much rereading of them.
They've got a lot.
Yeah, well, William Trevor died a couple years ago in his late 80s, and Alice Munro is in her late 80s now. And they were both short story writers. I mean, that's what they did. They definitely
over
have...
Over the course of, like, decades mm-hmm. then? I mean,
Yeah, 50 cool. years, each of them about. Yeah. Plenty of stuff, and just love digging into their work. I think you'd really dig them. I think you'd go for William Trevor in particular. I'll have to send you some stuff. I will.
You do that. I will follow up. I'll join you on the William Trevor journey.
Sounds good.
Excellent. Okay, Trevor. Well, it's nice to connect with you again. I'm sure we'll have you on here soon enough. I don't have my spreadsheet.
Yeah, I can't remember what's next for me.
Well, we'll be in touch. And listeners, thank you for checking us out. Give us your comments and feedback. We look forward to any response you may have. And we'll be talking to you again real soon. Our next one is going to be kind of a obscurity from the BBS set, Drive, He Said. And I've got a couple interesting guests lined up for that. I'll keep it a secret for now. But we'll be back to the BBS world in our next episode. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.